From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
Forty years ago, Arab nationalism was on the rise throughout the Middle East. Today, it's all but disappeared. Joining me now to discuss how that happened is Michael Hudson. He holds the Saif Gobash Chair at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies at Georgetown University, and he's the author of numerous books on the Middle East. I'm very pleased to welcome Professor Hudson to today's Backstory. Hello.
Nice to be with you.
Most people associate Arab nationalism with the former Egyptian leader Gamal Abdel Nasser. Is that when Arab nationalism developed?
No, actually, Arab nationalism goes back a good bit farther than that. Its origins are often traced to the end of the 19th century, during a period in which the Ottoman Empire, which ruled most of the Eastern Arab territories, was in decline and would eventually disappear. And as the movement, as the Ottomans became a little bit more oppressive as time went on, various Arab intellectuals and cultural figures began to get together in secret societies. And so even before World War I, you had the sort of incipient growth of the ideas in mostly in intellectual circles. It wasn't, I think, a mass movement at that point. But the idea that the Arabs were a nation and that they ought eventually to be independent.
Mostly within the Ottoman Empire or also in countries outside of it?
Well, mostly within the Ottoman Empire. At that point, the Ottoman Empire still encompassed most of North Africa and certainly the Mashrik, the eastern Arab world. So there were hardly any places where it wasn't there except in sort of Central Arabia, which became Saudi Arabia. And they lost their grip over Yemen somewhat early on. But in a sense, I think you can say that at the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century, the idea of nationalism in some ways had migrated from Europe. And many of the Arab intellectuals and elites had, in fact, studied in Europe. And as the Ottoman Empire began to tighten up before its collapse, and more importantly, as the European powers extended their colonial domination of the region, the idea of being sovereign and independent gained ground. But it's not really, I should say, until well after the First World War that Arab nationalism and related kinds of nationalism began to pick up more of a mass basis. And it's in the late 1940s and then in the 1950s that you begin to get a kind of an institutional and mass-based character to Arab nationalism, the development of the Ba'ath Party, the development of the Arab nationalists movement. And then, of course, as you mentioned, when Nasser came to power in the early and mid-50s, he appropriated the nationalist agenda and became its symbol. And that's when, I think, in the 50s and 60s, that the movement really hit its high spot. But when in the Six-Day War, in which the Arabs were humiliatingly defeated, and then shortly after when Nasser died, and the Ba'athists started squabbling among each other, that's when the movement fell into decline.
Well, we'll come to that in a moment. Is Arab nationalism the same thing as pan-Arabism?
Yes, I think they're probably essentially used interchangeably.
So what unites all the countries? Are Arabs united only through their language, or are there other parts of a common culture that links the country in their view?
Well, the early Arab nationalists did indeed stress language as a very kind of a core unifying character. And that's interesting in part because some of the early Arab nationalists were not Muslims, they were Christians. And the Christian Arab intellectuals played an important role in the beginnings of Arab nationalism. But apart from that, the sense of language, the sense of a common history, and indeed the sense of being part of a Muslim culture as well, all figured into the mix.
But how did they address the matter of tribal identity, which has been very important throughout the Middle East?
Well, it's a long and interesting struggle because the substructure to all this is the economic and social changes that were taking place in the region. Modernization begins to take root in parts of the Middle East by the end of the 18th century, and certainly in the great major urban centers, Cairo, Damascus, Beirut, Baghdad. The idea of a larger modern identity took root. Tribalism was, in a sense, on the wane, particularly as the economic structures began to change. Tribal areas shrank, and a lot of tribal people, in a sense, became more urban and less tribal. So it was, I think, it was sort of driven, if you will, by social and economic as well as kind of intellectual and ideological changes.
But we hear about tribalism even today. So,
oh, absolutely.
It wasn't eliminated.
No, it certainly wasn't. It was submerged and marginalized. A lot of the big state-building enterprises that took place in the region as the Arab states gradually became nominally and even formally independent in the period following World War I, part of the struggle was, in fact, to enlarge the state, to establish a bigger sense of the public and civic space, and to diminish parochial, tribal, if you will, ethnic and sectarian identities. This was the idea that most of the nationalists and the progressives had. Now, of course, in the intervening years since then, with the weakening of states and with the general tension and chaos in the region, tribalism in some ways has reasserted itself. And you can see this most dramatically indicated, of course, today in Iraq, where what had been a very modern state and nation-building enterprise starting from around 1920 gradually fell apart under the last decade of Saddam's rule. But then, of course, since the U.S. invasion of Iraq, it has become even more pronounced.
Well, Nasser wooed the Soviet Union. The Ba'ath parties call themselves socialists. So was that part of the vision?
Yes, I think it's fair to say that Arab nationalism in its heyday was quite closely associated with a kind of socialism, a kind of socialist vision. And there certainly was quite a lot of influence from the experience of Marx and Lenin. Although many of the Arab nationalists tried to keep their distance from embracing communism as such, partly because of the kind of, the religious culture in which they were still operating, which was quite inimical to the sort of belligerent anti-clerical atheism of Soviet communism. So you had other left-wing kinds of influences as well. Remember, back in the 50s and 60s, this was the era in which the Third World was kind of coming into its own. The last vestiges of colonial domination were being stripped away in Africa and Asia, and the Arabs, the Arab nationalists, felt that they were very much a part of this kind of growing third world between the two competing superpowers.
My guest is Michael Hudson, professor at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies at Georgetown University, and we're talking about the rise and fall, pretty much, of Arab nationalism. Why it happened. How did it become so popular in Egypt? Were the British, did the British play a role in all of that?
Well, the British play a role in practically everything in the modern political history.
Originally as supporters of Arab nationalism, because they thought of it as a counterbalance to the Ottoman Empire, didn't they?
Well, in a sense. If you go back, of course, to the era of Lawrence of Arabia, the sort of romanticized vision of it that we have, in which the British enlisted the Sharif of Mecca from the Hashemite family, from which the present rulers of Jordan are the survivors. Yes, the British found useful local supporters or clients, if you will, as they fought the Turks. And they fought the Turks because they were afraid that the Turks were too close to the Germans. And so in the context of World War II, the that kind of coalition pattern continued. So, but I think the overriding factor that drives that drove Arab nationalism into its populist phase, and indeed which drives the Islamist movement today, is in fact the colonial imperialist domination that has persisted in the region. And Nasser comes very much out of that tradition. Nasser is struggling against the British. The free officers and the many political parties are struggling against the residue of the British protectorate and the British domination and the British military bases that remained in Egypt up until 1954.
But like the reformers in Turkey, he's secular, and so are the new rulers in Syria and Iraq, and that becomes a major part of the story. But before we get to that, in 1958, Syria and Egypt, they're not even contiguous, try to unite as a country called the United Arab Republic. Was that, obviously that grows out of this sense of Arab nationalism. Did they really have any hopes that that experiment might succeed?
Well, I think they certainly did, but of course the experiment failed. It lasted only, I think, 3 years. And the lack of contiguity, you know, certainly makes a difference. But I think it's a testament to the power of the Arab nationalist ideal and with its kind of socialist and with its anti-colonial character that brought key ruling elites in both of those countries together. It's a strange story. Nasser originally, it is said, was very wary of joining with the Syrians, but the Syrian rulers at the time, who were kind of soft Arab nationalists, were afraid that the communists were going to take over in Syria. And so in some ways it was a marriage of convenience, but it fell apart finally in fairly short order. Because the Egyptians tried to rule Syria like they rule Egypt, which is very hierarchically and bureaucratically. The Syrians didn't really take to that, and the Syrian business class especially didn't take to it, and they were able finally in a bloodless secession in 1961 to break loose from that.
Is Syria the only remaining Arab nationalist regime?
Well, that's an interesting question. It is certainly the only remaining Ba'athist regime. Iraq, of course, for many years was the other Ba'athist Arab nationalist regime, and it is only a bit ironical, perhaps, that the two Ba'athist regimes couldn't stand each other. So unity was a pretty tough goal for them to achieve. But if you look around the region today, certainly there has been a great shrinkage of the regimes who rely essentially on Arab nationalism. If you were looking, say, in the mid-60s or even the early 70s, you would have said probably that Algeria, Libya, Egypt, Syria, Iraq, North Yemen, and South Yemen were, you know, sort of dominated by some kind of Arab nationalist ethos. And there were certainly elites in other countries, monarchies for the most part, like Morocco and Saudi Arabia and Jordan, who wished they could be a part of that, but one of the cleavages in contemporary Arab politics, in a sense, mirrored the divisions of the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union. So the Soviets had their Arab nationalist regimes, and the United States had its traditional conservative, monarchical, and often oil-rich regimes.
One of the key thinkers in the development of Islamism is Sayyid Qutb. He was tortured by Nasser. Eventually, he was executed in Egypt by that regime. But he endorsed the idea of ummah, meaning community. So isn't that similar to pan-Arabism?
Well, it is. And the term ummah, which is quintessentially an Islamic concept to denote the community of believers worldwide, was also used, but in a much more circumscribed territorial sense, by the Arab nationalists. One often heard Arab nationalist leaders and thinkers speaking of the Ummah al-Arabiya, which included all the places where most of the people spoke Arabic and were Muslims and shared this kind of ethno-national heritage or sort of collective memory. But the Islamic Ummah, of course, far extends beyond the Arab world. The Arabs are a minority in the world of Islam, and the Islamic movement theoretically claimed a much larger Ummah, a much larger space. And it goes back, incidentally, well before Sayyid Qutb. Sayyid Qutb emerges in the 1950s and indeed has left an important and I think essentially negative influence over the Salafists and the jihadis of today. But the granddaddy of the Islamic movement, in modern times at least, it goes back to Egypt in the late 1920s with the establishment of the Muslim Brotherhood. And that organization emerged in Egypt as a mass organization, somewhat in parallel with some of the nationalist and indeed some of the communist parties that were developing mass followings in the 20s and 30s.
Professor Hudson, we've pretty much run out of time, but I want to ask you one more question. Was the 1979 revolution in Iran the first Islamist government to take power, and does that Islamism now bridge the Sunni-Shia split?
Well, I think people would Iranians might say that, but Saudis, I think, would say no. You know, with the establishment of the Saudi kingdom, that's a real Islamic kingdom, and that goes back, depending on when you start counting, at least till the very beginning of the 20th century.
And we have to leave it there. I'm so sorry.
Okay, sorry that they couldn't bridge the Sunni-Shia gap, but that seems...
But it seems to be being bridged now with Hezbollah, but we will see, right? Professor Michael Hudson is the chair at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies at Georgetown University. I want to thank you so much for participating in Backstory today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.